Hi everyone, this is your co-host Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hi, Patty.
Hello, how are you tonight?
Doing fairly well. Can't complain. I have my mug and forward supply point of Canada's favorite coffee shop coffee, which I won't mention by name because they're not a sponsor, but you can guess. And so I'd also like to take this opportunity, if you are not subscribed, please consider clicking the subscribe button that's down below on whichever platform you're watching. Click the like button, give us a rating. You will also find links down below in the description for our Linktree. And just so that I don't have everything in the Linktree, because you may not want to click multiple places, I'll also put the links down to our Facebook groups, Patty's blog, Buy Me a Coffee, which no obligation, but if you feel nice, then send us a coffee. I know Patty would be happy to have coffee. I can't be the only one drinking it.
No, and I think I with drink that, it every day.
And I think with that, although I don't think you drink as much as I do.
No, 2 cups a day is my limit.
Yeah, I'm somewhere between the 10 and 12 cups a day. Although at some point I do say that I go to the decaf just so that I can sleep at night.
Yeah.
So anyway, so what do you have for us today?
Some very interesting and unusual Bigfoot sightings.
Oh.
And stories. Now, the first story isn't actually a sighting. It is actually a footprint. I was doing the research on this, and I came across this, which I found to be interesting. Now, we live not so far from Johnstown, Pennsylvania. I did not realize until I was doing the research that one of the most famous Bigfoot sightings in the state of Pennsylvania, so to speak, actually occurred in August 26th of 1980 in the Conemaugh Township of Johnstown.
Wow, so, I did not know that.
I didn't either. So apparently what happened is that there was it isn't actually a Bigfoot itself, but it's they found the uninterrupted muddy footprints. So they were really well cast of a creature it was a right foot that they found, like multiple steps. It had 6 toes. And there was a left footprint found 8 feet away. So that's the stride, 8 foot stride. And it was so good. It had dermal ridges, the whole nine yards.
Wow.
And it was one of the best big footprints ever taken. It was 17 3/4 inches long. It was found near the home of somebody who had been saying they were hearing and seeing something in the woods around their house. So after this rainstorm, they had heard some stuff. They went out and they were looking around and came across this. They covered the prints so that they were safe. Then they called in the authorities. Now, what makes this interesting is that this case was newsworthy enough that the Associated Press picked up the article of this potential encounter. It has never been solved. It has not been debunked as a prank. So whatever it was, these prints are highest quality, highest class there could be. And I just thought it was fascinating that one of the best known casts of a Bigfoot in the world turns up to be in Johnstown. You know, I would have expected the Northwest, maybe something like that, but I didn't know it was that close to home. For us, it's like, 40 miles?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I can. Well, I mean, Johnstown kind of sprawled, Conemaugh Township. So yeah, not far at all. I wouldn't want to walk it, but you know, I can't. So.
It's all mountain.
Exactly.
And from where you're at, it's all uphill.
Both ways.
Yeah. So anyway, but I thought I'd share that, and then I wanted to kind of move
before you go to the next one. I'm sorry. Were there any UFO sightings nearby at the same time?
I didn't find anything that correlated with it, but I did find that there were other people in the same area, general area, who were also reporting sounds and sightings and stuff like that. So there was someone or something in those woods that was carrying on for a while. And I wanted to start with like a little bit of evidence and then go on to some really interesting stories. So we're going to go on to Mount Everest. This is the Mae Lung Basin, 1951. British explorer Earl Shipton was at the 19,000 foot level when he stumbles across 12 to 13 inch footprints in the snow. Now he is, at the time he is, you know, climbing Mount Everest, and he had with him a mountaineer by the name of Thomas Bourdillon, who photographed the tracks, and they put a ice pick on the ground beside him, so that like a little ice shovel or hammer, so that they could get a perspective on their size. And they were found as they were going down a section of glacier. And I thought that it was just really fascinating. There's an entire row of these tracks that you can actually, there's photographs, and I there's an entire row of these tracks. So it looks like something was just walking along and they happened to stumble across the same trail. So this is like 25 years after the Royal Geographic Society photographer N.A. Tombazzi had first become the first European to report a similar type of encounter while scaling Mount Everest. He claimed he saw a Yeti and took photographs. There was no animals in the area that grew to the size. The snow had not melted, so they hadn't changed shape in any way. And of course, Sir Edmund Hillary, most people are familiar with him as an explorer. He was the first European to reach Mount Everest, launched an expedition, and he tried really hard to find a Yeti creature, spent years looking. He offered his images of the Yeti-like footprint and the creature went on auction at Christie's Auction House in 2014, and they sold for $10,000. So that's kind of interesting. I mean, there was a series of very well-renowned, famous explorers who actually came across these kind of footprints. And then, so, you know, we're not talking people who are not trained observers. We're not talking people who are not familiar with the landscape that they're traversing. Some of these people made multiple attempts at climbing Mount Everest. They knew the terrain. They knew what kind of animals were on those mountains. They knew as much about it as they humanly could, because literally that could be the difference between life and death. So these were trained observers and trained to their environment. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you'd think that the Sherpas would have a lot of stories.
I'm sure there, and I've actually listened and read stories from Sherpas that, you know, were leading expeditions like that. So it was really interesting. So the next story I wanted to talk about is from Walla Walla. It comes from the Walla Walla Union Bulletin. A gentleman by the name of Paul Freeman presented the story about in 1982. He was an experienced former U.S. Forestry Service patrolman. And he'd also become kind of a cryptozoologist, like looking into unfound species and what have you. And this is whenever he has the experience that changes his life. So Freeman obviously knew his way around Washington State, having worked as a in the Forest Service there for many years. He was a seasoned woodsman. He knew all of it. And he came across the footprint in the Blue Mountains near Walla Walla. Excuse me. There, he had no camera, but he took plaster casts of the prints instead. And they are now in Washington State University, where Grover Krantz has declared them to be the real thing. They are definitely cryptid of unknown origin. And it's a fascinating story. If you ever get to examine them, they're online. In 1994, in the same area, Freeman was walking around when he encountered the thing that would completely convince him forever that there is such a thing as a Bigfoot. So this is his story, guys. So 10 years after he takes the pictures of these and or the casts of these prints, he's walking around in the woods out in the Walla Walla area, and he comes upon in the distance two Bigfoots he thinks are female, attending to their young. This time he has a camera. So the quality is kind of grainy. He took photographs. And for some reason, until I read this article. I had no clue. I mean, everybody knows about the Patterson-Gimlin footage, and they always say that's the best footage there is. And today, it is probably still the best footage. But until Patterson-Gimlin took their pictures, Paul Freeman's were the best photographs ever taken at that point in time. And I think that was just, I found it fascinating. So if you get a chance to look them up, Paul Freeman's photographs are out there and you can see them. Now we're going to go to Florida's Lettuce Lake Park. I never even heard of it until recently. So it's about a 240-acre park, also known as a place where the skunk ape is seen, Florida's version of the Bigfoot. Native American tribes from the area have been talking about the skunk ape forever. They've warned people about it. There were some outdoorsmen who were there at the park, a guy by the name of Matthew McCamey and his friend, and they actually saw a skunk ape. This is their story that I'm about to tell. So they first heard a noise and rustling movement in the trees. They grabbed, McCamey grabbed his phone to take pictures, and he thought they were going to find an alligator or a bear or something like that. But as he gets closer to wherever that noise was, he begins to see what it is. And this is a quote. In that moment, I was looking at it and getting a little freaked out, especially once it started really moving. You could tell he was slapping the water, and it looked like he was maybe grabbing at something. At the time, I was just thinking, holy,
oops, uh-oh,
what the H is this? And he was watching this thing smacking the water, probably, if I were guessing, grabbing for a fish or something, you know? And he said that whatever you want to call it, a skunk ape or a Bigfoot, this is what we saw. We got a good chance to look at it. It's not a bear. I know that. It wasn't a human. It's like a once-in-a-lifetime experience. We were there. The likelihood of it ever happening again is almost nothing. And they were so amazed, him and his friend, but they were also kind of traumatized by it because this was something that was beyond their purview. So they decided that they would not go back, and they decided not to talk about it. But McCamey decides later on that he was mad at himself for stopping the filming to run, because this is like, you know, one of those stay put and you got a once in a lifetime piece of video. But he broke and ran when his friend ran, which of course drew the attention of the creature. And I have to tell you, I would have been ahead of them, even though I'm an old chick, just saying.
Yeah.
So he takes the footage that he did get, and he takes it to a former police officer in Oregon, a guy he knew named Phil Poling. And Poling looked at the footage, and he said, you know, whatever it was, this guy actually spent a lot of years looking as a cryptozoologist as a second career in his life. He said, I came away from this with a distinct impression. I have no idea what this is. It could be a guy in a costume. It could be the real thing. I don't know. And he sent it. He sent the evidence to other places and other people, and they can affirm that the video footage was not altered in any sort. Was not a fake in that respect. It wasn't like computer altered or anything of that nature. Whatever it was definitely there. And the guy has not been afraid. McKinney has not been afraid to share the footage, so it's out there, and he's completely convinced of the veracity of what he saw and what he recorded. You know, a lot of times they'll pull it whenever people start saying, well, it's a fake, or it's this, or it's a that, and they'll start to pull the footage. He's like, go right ahead, you can examine it all you want. Yeah, you should check it out. So we're going to go to North Carolina, where the heading for this I thought was really interesting. It says, North Carolina Bigfoot sighting has made a believer out of a skeptic. So let's go into this story. So in North Carolina, and there's the Uwari National Forest, there's been a ton of Bigfoot sightings there for years and years and years. There's an area in that area called the El Dorado Outpost. And this is an area where there's been a lot of sightings. So a fraud investigator and former military commander, Michael Green, was in the area. And this would have been like 2005-ish. He's out there looking around, camping, having a good time. He's all by himself at night. I have to tell you, if there's one piece of information to give everybody out there, don't go out camping by yourself because you're going to get kidnapped by a UFO, have a Bigfoot encounter. I mean, like, have you ever noticed that it's always the dude who's out there by himself?
Oh, yeah. How many of your stories have just absolutely ruined the outdoors for me?
Well, you can go just with somebody else.
Yeah, I'm just kidding, everybody. But, you know, I've made light of that situation, you know, like all the different places that are now off limits. But
so, well, anyhow, Green is out there. He's camping, and he hears rustling in the leaves. So he gets curious, and he starts looking, and then he sees that whatever it is rustling through the leaves is coming in his direction. And this is what he said. 2 seconds later, it was right over my tent, and it wasn't nearly as loud as I thought it was. It scared the devil out of me, though, and as you can imagine, as it gave out a bellow. 2 nights later, he heard the same thing again, and this time he had friends who had come and met him in the interim and had joined him to camp. So maybe my theory isn't going to hold water, but so his friends are still out there with him, and they catch a glimpse of a bipedal ape-like animal moving in the distance away from their camp as though it had been there kind of looking around. And when they caught sight of it, it seemed to recognize that it had been found out and started going away. And now Green, being a former military officer, begins calculating its size based upon its surroundings. So he's marking what branch it's near, its head came under as it's going under the trees, things like that. And he has footage of the sighting. One of the guys pulled his phone up and began to shoot. He said he guessed that the measurements compared with the trees was about 7.5 to 8 foot tall. Its stride was exactly like you would have seen in the Patterson-Gimlin footage, where it's moving with the arms swaying and swinging side to side. He said his biggest mistake of my life was that I personally did not start recording. I was too mesmerized by what I saw. And, you know, that was actually something Patterson and Gimlin talked about. Like, it took them a few minutes to, or a few seconds to get everything set up. They didn't mean to. The only reason they stopped in that spot when that thing came out of the woods there in front of them was because the mule threw the rider off, and he grabbed the camera and stuff and began to film. So, you know, you hear that a lot. And so determined to capture this creature again, Green returns to the same woods a week later. Now, this time he's got a camper, and he's got a range of cameras from night vision to thermal, everything that you could possibly imagine. And he keeps going out there over and over again. This is what I love, is when somebody is this dedicated. So it's 2009 till he gets his picture. So we're talking 2005 to 2009. This time, he gets a picture of this creature or one like it stealing from one of his traps. He's got baited traps out there with food, hoping that one of these animals will come out of the woods to grab the food. Apparently, it liked candy bars because it stole a candy bar.
You know, the weirdest thing is that went through my head before you even said it.
Really?
I was thinking of Snickers. Yeah.
And he doesn't tell me what candy bar, but he wired the area with candy bars. Mm-hmm. And then put thermals and what have you. So one of his thermal imaging cameras caught it stealing a candy bar. And he said, I know what I saw. I don't care if anyone thinks I'm crazy, but by God, I'm going to prove this one way or the other. And I hope I can prove this before I die. And so he has spent a lot of time out there. And it's interesting because he is completely convinced. He says that, you know, the arguments that he hears so often is things like, you know, well, if they were really out there would be skeletons found. And he said, how many mountain lion skeletons do you find? How many deer that are killed naturally, not necessarily at the end of hunting season or something? He's like, nature takes care of this very quickly. I'm telling you, these things exist. So I thought it was really an interesting story. If you can imagine, that's tenacity to go back out there over and over again for 4 years till you get it.
Well, once you see something like that, and if you're determined to not vindicate yourself, but at least prove that you've seen that, I think you would have the same degree of tenacity as that. At least I would, I think. But.
See, I have to say I probably would be the same. I have to agree because I was that way with ghosts. That's, I wanted that tangible evidence at the beginning. And I went out over and over and over and over again. Okay, so moving on to our next story. So this next story is going to be from Oregon. By the way, Oregon has the second most amount of Bigfoot sightings in the entire United States.
Yeah, I spent a little bit of time in the high desert of Oregon. When I was in the Air Force, I was based out of Beale Air Force Base, northern, it's just north of Sacramento. And one of my duties, occasional duties, was to drive up into Oregon around Bend and Crater Lake, that area. And there were some inspections I had to perform. I don't want to be any more explicit than that, but. Yeah, I went through areas where I know that there's, it's wide open. So that doesn't surprise me a lot that there was, of course, I always kept my eyes open looking for anything, but the most I ever found was cattle crossing the road most of the time. And imagine driving down a road at 6 a.m. and having to stop coming up over a crest of a hill to allow the cattle to cross the road. But, yeah. Sorry for that distraction, but that's I
No,
can
that's not a distraction.
knowing just how remote, the western part, I'm sorry, the eastern part of Oregon is, I could certainly understand that.
Yeah, I was surprised to find that it was the second most in the entire country. So we're going to go back and visit probably one of the best stories of Bigfoot ever. And this is the Mount St. Helens story in Washington State, come right around the border of Oregon, if you're wondering why I mentioned Oregon. So this is 1924, and prospectors Fred Beck, John Peterson, Gabe Lefevre, and Marion Smith and Smith's son Roy were all in the area working at a place called Spirit Lake. They had an encounter that was reported in the Oregonian newspaper at the time. So this is 1924. They claim that they saw four gorilla men. They didn't call them Bigfoot back then, just they looked like gorilla men, covered with long black hair. They guessed their weight to be about 400 pounds each. Their ears were 4 inches long and stuck straight up, which is different than what we hear today. They had four toes that were short and stubby. They knew that because they had seen the footprints. And Beck was, I don't know if you call it careless, but he shot, deliberately shot his rifle and shot one of them off of the cliff where they were standing. He thought that would drive the animals away. So he they gather the creature and the dead one, and they take it to their cabin for the night, thinking they're going to leave in the morning. Now their cabin, it's just an old rough log cabin. There's nothing special about it. During the middle of the night, they are attacked by a group of these gorilla men. And they said that it literally shook to its foundations as they slammed against the walls. And one began to tear a hole in the roof of the cabin. There were rocks that were dropped through the roof of the cabin into the room below. One hit Beth, knocking him unconscious for almost 2 hours. They waited until the beginning of dawn, and that by then there was a little silence. They weren't sure if they were still out there, and they decided to run for the truck and try to get out of there. So that's exactly what they did. They escaped, and they decided on the way down out of the mountain they were not going to tell anyone ever what was going on. However, by word of mouth, how people are, they tell stories. The story very quickly got out about this violent encounter, and the U.S. Forest Service launched an inquest into the story. They couldn't find anything except for the ruins of the cabin, because the cabin was in pretty bad shape. You could definitely see that it had been under siege of some sort. There was the body that they had drug off to the cabin was gone. And the only thing that they could find was were 14-inch footprints in the dirt around the cabin and going off into the woods. Later on, the reporter would learn that the Native American people called it Abe Canyon. And it had been well known to be an area frequented by whatever you want to call them, Bigfoots, ape men, whatever. And I thought that was really interesting. And it is one of them, like I've listened to them talk. A couple of them were interviewed before they passed away. And they talk about, you know, how terrifying that night was because you didn't know if they were going to get through at any minute. If they ripped a hole large enough to drop huge rocks down, you know, they could very well have ripped it a little larger and dropped in on them themselves. And with them being so big and muscular, they could have killed them. Now, why they didn't choose to do that, I don't know, the Bigfoot, but they definitely took their dead, and which I think actually is a really interesting thing, because when you realize that might very well be the reason why we don't find anything of them. They take their dead.
I was going to say that that was maybe a sense of higher intelligence, but then, I mean, animals like, I mean, even ants will collect their dead and retrieve them. No, I mean, ants do have a, you know, a collective, you know, intelligence amongst them. But, you know, to me, that indicates some type of sentience where you're going to, you know, retrieve that. Now, what they did with them after that, that's a mystery, you know. Are there burials? You know, that would be really fascinating to come across a Bigfoot burial ceremony.
Yeah, I mean, I've never heard of any, but they definitely do seem to live. I've got about maybe three or four stories where somebody came across a carcass or said they killed a Bigfoot. And in every instance, it seems like they go to extraordinary lengths to gather their dead. So it does seem, and it's common all the way through from Alaska, all the way through the continental United States. You hear these stories consistently. So our next one is actually going to take place in 2019 in a place called Mayflower Gulch in Summit County, Colorado. So it's the summertime, and a Pulitzer Prize winning newspaper, the Gazette, reports the story. So we'll give credit to where credit's due. There were a couple hikers, actually three altogether, and they were out hiking, and one of them disappeared, just gone. So the other two decide that they're going to go back and get help. And it's then that they see this Bigfoot creature, and they start to think that this thing might be what took their buddy. Now, this is really high up, so there's still snow, even though it's summer, up in the upper part of the mountains. And they can't figure out where it's gone to. They photographed whatever they could find. They found handprints in the snow. They found footprints of the bipedal creature in the snow, not of the human. But there are stories of Bigfoots picking humans up and carrying them off. So, you know, that's neither here nor there. But they did believe, and that their friend got taken. One of the guys was interviewed, and he said, "I believe what I saw was a Sasquatch, probably a young individual caught in a compromising situation in the daytime in a fairly high traffic area." So what he's talking about is it was caught out in the open. Mm-hmm. And it seemed very shocked and took off. And then later on, their buddy disappeared. And they don't know why, how this happened, and if he had anything, but they found footprints around it. So the Bigfoot Research Organization actually looked into the case, and they went up there. They heard wood knocking. But the other hiker was not found. They did find some really interesting photographs from other people in that area, general area, and they found that the entire area was just completely wall-to-wall stories from people They found another couple who came upon a Bigfoot in the same area. And their story was pretty much that it was like late in the afternoon, late summer afternoon, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. They began to hear a howling, roaring sound. It scared them, so they decided to take off and leave. They, as they were leaving, they saw something in the bushes, large and dark haired, crashing through the bushes, walking on 2 feet, not walking like a bear, that lumbering thing the bear does, but more like a human with their arms swinging. They kind of got themselves together and went back and could not find anything of it, but they were completely convinced that they saw most likely a Bigfoot. And again, it's in the same area where this other event occurred. So I want to talk about another one. So we're going to go to Frisco, Colorado. And this would have been the early 2000s. There were hikers in the area who were taking a break when they saw something strange on the mountains that were snow-capped above them. At about the 11,000 feet range, they saw a tall, dark, hairy figure fall. Like he's walking along, they're watching it, and then it kind of stumbles and falls like on its hands and knees. They don't see it get up. So they start forward to see if there was anyone there, if they were injured. They weren't sure what they were seeing at the time. And it would have been death to leave a man up there if he fell and like broke his leg or something. He wouldn't be able to get out. So they decided to go up and walk. They don't find the person or the bee. They do find footprints and handprints in the snow. And they report it to the police then when they come down because they're still concerned that someone or something was up there and injured. There are a lot of these sightings that are just amazing to me when you look at them because there's just so many. But now I want to talk about some that are a little more dangerous. So we're going to go to the Okefenokee Swamp in 1829. So people think about Bigfoot, they think about normal recent sightings, but there are stories that come all the way back from the 1700s in the United States. Sometimes even in the 1600s, you'll find trapper and trader records that talk about hairy beast men and stuff like that. They didn't use the term Bigfoot, but that kind of gives you the idea. So this story from 1829 is about two men and a child who went into the swamp to explore, and they came across footprints of something that were had feet that were 18 inches long and 9 inches wide. They were really scared. The men were really scared by what they saw. Whatever it was huge to make footprints like that. So they headed home and eventually start talking to other folks about what they were telling them, stay out of the swamp. There's this big monster out there that whatever it is, it's a brute. But some hunters decided to go out there and take a look around. So there were six hunters that ended up going in to hunt this thing, whatever it was. After a few days of tracking, they came across an area where they found some footprints and they decided to camp there and see what they could come up with. Now, they were in that time frame, they would have had black powder guns. So they ended up shooting off their black powder to clear their guns and put dry powder in case they came near this thing. And that's whenever they claim that it spooked whatever this thing was that was hiding there watching them. And this is what it said. They said one of them got a good shot at the beast and hit it in the chest. And they claimed it was 13 foot tall, covered in
Wow.
coarse hair. And several of the men took off running. The guy who shot it was kind of frozen. Two of the other men took off in the other direction. They left the body of their of the Bigfoot, whatever you want to call it, in the swamp. And this is interesting because at the very beginning, they said it managed to kill five of the men before succumbing to their bullets. So there had to be more than six in the party. There was a guy that was well, okay, there's seven, we'll say seven, because there was a guy who led the men, six in the party, and they just pass over this really quickly. It killed five of the guys, two took off running, you know, and so we got seven people there already. And they left everything in the woods, the bodies of the guys, the bodies of the body of the Bigfoot, and none of them were ever recovered. But the story has continued on for years. Two of the men who escaped told the story to the local police, and the story was well known in the area. And this story passed on through, literally through years and years, and we're now, you know, a couple centuries into it. The story has never gone away. And there are written accounts from the two men who survived and the reports in local area papers and stuff from that time period. So somebody believed the story to be true. I thought that was really interesting story, because I'd never heard that kind of a story. And 13 feet, think about that.
Yeah, that was... Amongst all the stories you've told before, I don't think any of them have been that tall.
No, the only thing I've ever come across that was 13 feet would have been Nephilim. You'll hear stories of them being that tall. Angels. But any creature, bipedal humanoid type creature, never. It's an insane story. The next one is going to come from 1895, and this is going to take place in California. So this is a story that was told in 1895 about a wild man that attacked some lumberjacks in Northern California. So that's a mountainous region up there. Now, Lorne Coleman, for those who don't know, Lorne Coleman is, by my estimation, probably the premier cryptozoologist in the country. In his time frame, he was and is a phenomenal man, and I can offer you nothing but mad respect for Lorne Coleman. I've known him for years, and he's a really interesting and cautious investigator. So Lorne dug up an article that showed up in the San Francisco newspaper, The Call, and it talks about the wild men attacking a lumber camps, not just a lumber camp, but lumber camps in that region. Over the past 2 months, men keep disappearing from the camps and their bodies are found mangled by what appears to be an animal. One lumberjack stated that while working, he was attacked by a wild man and was only able to fend him off because he had an axe with him. The beast is described as being as stealthy as an animal with long, shaggy beard and skin coat. The lumberjacks believe he was a hunter who was lost in the wood for weeks and has gone insane. But others described him as being covered in shaggy fur. It's an interesting story. Don't know if it's true or if it's not true, but it's definitely an interesting story. We're going to talk about 1950, disappearance of Jim Carter. So in May of 1950, a professional mountaineer by the name of Jim Carter disappeared in Ape Canyon. We're going to go back to Ape Canyon. And he was taking 20 people from Seattle up to Mount St. Helens. He left the group at a place called Dog Heads Peak, telling them he would ski back down. And he was an accomplished man. That's what he did for a living. So he knew what he was doing. Then nobody ever saw Carter again. The next morning, Seattle's Mountain Search and Rescue set up a unit and they began to look for Carter. They found that he had a camera that had discharged a photo. And Carter's ski tracks are found as he's going down the mountain. He was taking chances, but again, he knew this mountain like the back of his hand. This is where he worked. There was something strange on the high slopes of the mountain. According to investigators, that seemed to, they would see glimpses of it. This is a quote. "It was the most eerie experience I've ever had," said Lee, one of the search and rescue team. "There was something strange on the mountain slopes, high up. I could feel the hair on my neck stand up. It was eerie. I was unarmed except for my axe. And believe me, I never let go of that. Carter's complete disappearance is an unsolved mystery to this day. And I will never go back there. I believe the mountain devils got him. So he's never found, ever. Not his, even though this, and I have to say, I want to make a point of saying that this is an area that's well traveled. So even though it sounds terribly remote because of the Bigfoot stories and because it's so rough and beautiful terrain, a lot of people go there. You know, so there, it's a pretty well traveled area. You would expect a hiker or somebody to come across some evidence, even if it was just a random ski or a piece of clothing or a piece of skull or something, you know. But there's nothing at all. And I have to tell you, one of the things I've been looking at, and I'm probably going to do an episode somewhere down the road, is about killer Bigfoots. And I have seen some really amazing stories and know of some really amazing stories of Bigfoots that have attacked humans. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, in the mid-1800s, there's a story of a family. It was a man, his son, and his teenage son, and his daughter, who was a teenager. The son was probably about 18, 19. The girl was about 15, 16 years old. Something started taking food out of their root cellar. They would, like, you know, smoked hams and vegetables and things stored away for the winter, and they began missing food. This is a really worrisome thing, because, like, you weren't going to the AMP to get groceries. You know, you got what you raised, and that was it. So they began watching very closely what was going on. And one night, the boy went out to get wood to take in the house, you know, for the fire. And his dad and his sister are in the house, and all of a sudden, they hear this horrendous scream from the boy. His sister goes running out the door. His dad runs for the gun. And they see a hairy man attacking this boy, and it breaks his leg as it's trying to tear at him. And sister goes running out hysterical. She grabs up a piece of wood and she starts wailing on this thing, trying to make it let go of her brother. Then dad lets off a shot into the air, and that was enough to scare it, and it went away. But there were multiple sightings in that area over the course of about a month or two. And the boy was badly injured.
Yeah, especially with a broken leg. I mean, that's, if you know how to set one, that's okay, but.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, and then I have to tell you, they called them gorillas. When I was doing a reading on, as I did a lot of reading for the Pennsylvania's Monsters, and a lot of newspaper articles and things of that nature when I was writing that book. Like, it was really interesting. I would read a lot of articles from newspapers, and it would say, like, that story. A gorilla escaped from the circus and attacked a young man at, you know, and then they would tell the story and they'd say, but the gorilla was never found. And then you would read later and there was no gorillas reported missing. And I'm like, well, then how did we get a gorilla? But they didn't want to say what it was. I don't even think they needed to have a name for it, to be honest.
I was going
to
say, you know, how do you describe something you don't have a word for? Yeah.
So, you know, they would talk about shaggy men, hairy men, things like that. You would see multiple stories like that in that Lancaster area in the mid-1800s. There were multiple accounts of root cellars being raided, food being taken. But in conjunction with these sightings of these wild men, hairy men, gorilla men, whatever the local paper decided to call them. So it was really interesting. And, like, one of these days I might just, you know, like, do some of those kinds of stories, because there's a lot of them. The first one I ever came across, one of the first sightings I've ever personally seen, was written up in a newspaper from the mid-1700s, and it was about some berry pickers who went outside of Philadelphia and were picking berries, and they called it the Whistling Bigfoot, and or the Whistling Monster. It was a Whistling Bigfoot in the story. Basically, what was going on is there was a young man picking berries, and he came across this juvenile Bigfoot, and it was whistling. I mean, I don't know what, it was like a strange whistling sound it was making, and that's what drew his attention to it. And then he got attacked by it and yelled for help. When people came crashing over to help him, it took off. But he estimated it was, he thought it was a juvenile, about 6 foot tall. and it was out there eating berries in that berry briars and making this weird whistling sound whenever he encountered it. So if you like Bigfoot stories and you have any of your own accounts, I hope folks will come and tell us some of their stories. We've gotten some really cool ghost stories and what have you through the last couple of years, but we haven't gotten anybody to tell us they've seen a Bigfoot, a UFO, anything like that. But please share them. And with that, I am done for this evening with this story.